Good morning. It is so good to see everyone. It is good to see the new faces. Kathy and the Binkleys, Sharon Burba is here. Others continue to come back, and we're thrilled to see you. Folks at home, know we miss you, know we love you, know whenever it is that we get to see you, we're going to look forward to that. And in the meantime, we continue to be here for you. There is a couple that I know is going to come back soon and is reading our scripture this morning. And so if you have your Bible, you can open up to Luke 22. That's where we'll be, and you'll see that on the screen behind me as Ben and Donna Wedor read a scripture for us from Luke 22.
Good morning. We're going to be reading from Luke 22, 24 through 30. A dispute also arose among them as to which of them was considered to be the greatest. Jesus said to them, "The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors. But you are not to be like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest, and the one who rules like the one who serves.
For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who is at the table? But I am among you as one who serves. You are those who have stood by me in my trials, and I confer on you a kingdom, just as my Father conferred on me, so that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on the thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel."
Okay, I kind of feel bad about something that happened a couple of weeks ago. A couple of weeks ago, I had an audience participation time in which there was an opportunity to win a $10 Starbucks gift card. Some of you may remember this. I showed the picture from the rover Perseverance, and in particular, I showed the parachute, that multicolored parachute, and I asked a question about that. And I feel bad because I guess the question I asked was too hard because no one got that question correctly. So no one won the $10 Starbucks gift card. Now that happened to be the first Sunday that DeWitt was back, and I was so happy to see DeWitt that I just gave him the gift card. So we all still came out a winner on that Sunday since DeWitt got the gift card. But I want to give you a chance to redeem yourselves. And I'm going to give me a chance to redeem myself with maybe a better question. So here we go. There is another chance for, you guessed it, a $10 Starbucks gift card. They came in a four-pack. Don't judge me, people. You're going to see this periodically for a while until I run out or until I just want a latte myself, and then maybe the questions are over. Okay. You can wait until the end, and I'll try to look. I don't have a helper this week, so I'll try to see who raises their hand. Don't raise it yet. There is a one-word acronym. You'll remember what an acronym is in a minute if you don't remember right now. It's risen to popularity, especially over the last 5 years or so, although it's been around for a long time. There is also an emoji of an animal that people use when they talk about this acronym. And it is a description used to refer to someone who has risen above everyone else in their field. So it's an acronym used to describe someone who's risen above everyone else in their field. There is an emoji of an animal that goes with it. I haven't even asked, but I love how eager you are. So let me get to my question. And then the first hand I saw was Michelle's. I'm going to give one more hint, even though Michelle thinks she already knows it. But I'm going to give one more hint, and this may bring a few more of you along. This acronym was used ad nauseum for the weeks leading up to the Super Bowl and following the Super Bowl to describe Tom Brady. So here's the question, and then we'll see if Michelle has the answer for us. What is the one word acronym popularly used to describe someone who's risen above her or his peers, and what does it stand for? Okay, Michelle? Okay. Okay, so this is, you guys can go in together on a Starbucks. GOAT, greatest of all time, survey says. That is correct. Yeah, there was a light smattering of applause for your correct answer there. Not terribly enthusiastic, but I'm enthusiastic for you. Yes. Okay, so Amber got it. Not surprising to me. So it's used a lot within the last month, month and a half for Tom Brady, but it is used a lot, especially in sports conversations. People throw around that term GOAT all the time. So I heard it not long ago talking about Serena Williams in tennis. I heard it not long ago talking about Tiger Woods in golf. I heard it this summer when the Michael Jordan documentary was going, talking about Michael Jordan and basketball, when Kobe Bryant passed away and that tragedy. Heard about it talking about Kobe Bryant, greatest of all time. It is an interesting sports conversation, or at least interesting if you care at all about sports, because this conversation turns into a debate. If you talk about someone as the GOAT, as the greatest of all time, then it's inviting a variety of questions. Are you talking any athlete? Or are you talking a particular sport? Are you saying the accomplishments that they've had on a team level or an individual level? Is it about the accolades that they've got? Is it about the championships that they've won or the gold medals that they've won? And how do you compare from different eras? Someone who played baseball in the 20s versus someone who plays in the 2020s. How do you compare when there was only one group of people that played baseball in the 20s? And it was segregated, and then you broaden it and you bring in more, and then you broaden it where people from all over the world are playing. And if you continue that conversation in baseball, how do you compare a pitcher to a catcher or a third baseman? Are you talking defense? Are you talking offense? And even if you're talking offense, are you talking the greatest home run hitter? Because that's a different conversation than the greatest hitter. And on this can go. And this is an interesting debate, an interesting conversation for podcasts and radio programs and friends sitting around a table at Buffalo Wild Wings, at least for those who care about sports. Now, I also realize that some of you have slowly slipped into a boredom-induced coma the longer I've talked about qualifications and qualities of a GOAT. You don't care a thing. So let me tell you, and folks at home, if you just muted me for the last couple of minutes because you've checked out, you were tired of the conversation, we know this is the kind of conversation that happens not just around sports, but about all kinds of areas of life. Who is the greatest? And then you fill in the blank. Who is the greatest actor of all time? Who's the greatest musician of all time, the greatest politician or president? And inevitably, when you get into these kinds of discussions, then you have to ask, well, what's the criteria? How do you make that decision? What factors into the discussion? Which brings us back to the Gospel of Luke. And if you've journeyed with us through this study of Luke, then you know that this is a conversation that has popped up before. In fact, we read it in chapter 9 when the disciples are getting into a debate over who's the greatest. So 9:46, you'll see it on the screen behind me. An argument started among the disciples as to which of them would be the greatest. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, took a little child and had him stand beside him. And then he said to them, whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me, for it is the one who is least among you all who is the greatest. Well, Jesus said it. That settles it. We've got our answer. The least is the greatest. Jesus followers will never struggle with this again. Done and done. Am I right? Well, yeah, not exactly. So, we're nearing the end of this study in the Gospel of Luke. And you've already heard it from chapter 22, so let me give you a little background. The crucifixion is imminent. Jesus knows that death is at its door, is at his door, and it's time to instill certain values, certain priorities, and also a practice that will help his followers remember him and remember what's important and remember what's at the heart of the gospel and remember what's at the heart of Jesus. Jesus is establishing a practice, a sacrament, a means of grace that will remind his followers on a regular basis of what is critical. And so Jesus and the 12 are gathered in the upper room, and they are sharing the Passover together. But Jesus is taking this really meaningful yearly meal, and he's reframing it. He's recasting it. This Passover is now being fulfilled in a new way with me. And this meal will never be the same. You will never see it the same because of what I'm about to do, that I am going to become the Passover lamb, the sacrifice for the sins of the people. But it's not just the Passover that he reframes. He takes two of the most basic elements of life, something that most every person in the ancient world consumed on a regular, if not daily, basis. And he recasts those. He reframes those. He says, I want you to remember differently and remember me. Every time you take bread, ordinary, life-giving, life-sustaining, daily bread, this bread is now so much more. It is a reminder of my body and my body broken. Eat. Remember. Live this new life that my body makes possible. And every time you drink wine, which was a regular, if not daily, occurrence for most in the ancient world, when you drink, this is not just wine. This is a reminder of my blood poured out, the lengths to which I will go in love, the sacrifice I make to bring peace in the world, connection between God and connection with others. Drink it, remember it, rest in it, find restoration in it. And then he says in the next three verses, things are picking up pace now. I'm going to be betrayed. One of you is going to betray me. The arrest, the crucifixion, it's imminent. And so they get into an argument. Who is it? It's not going to be me. It's going to be you. Who's going to be the one who betrays Jesus? And naturally, if you get into an argument about who is the worst among you, you might as well go ahead and have one more argument. Any guess what that argument is? You already know because you already heard it, and we've been talking about it all morning. They just debate about who's going to be the worst, who's going to betray them. So they go ahead and say, while we're at it, let's go ahead and have an argument about who's the greatest. There are some things that just don't mix. Oil and water, that's one we always say. Oil and water, they just don't mix. Taste buds that work and kale, they just don't mix. They don't go together. And a commemorative meal that Jesus has just established, where he talks about the sacrifice he's about to make, the extent of love he's about to show, that there is no depth to which he will go, that he will not go, to make a way for us to be with God. That meal and this debate just do not go together. And obviously, the message from chapter 9 has worn off. So let's hear again what he says right after their debate. Jesus said to them, "The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors. But you are not like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest." Remember chapter 9 here, people? "And the one who rules like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who is at the table? But I am among you as one who serves. You are those who have stood by me in all my trials, and I confer on you a kingdom, just as my Father conferred one on me, so that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." So they all know the drill. In the ancient world, people in positions of power and authority use those positions to maintain their positions, to have their preferences played out, to get their way. They lord that power and that prominence over other people. Even those who would call themselves benefactors, Jesus says, which is a good thing, except when you use your money, your means, not as a way to bless others, but simply as one more way to build yourself up, to get more power and hold on to more power. And that's what he's saying the benefactors are doing. These were people in the ancient world who had a lot of money, but they used that money simply as a way to advance their own interest, even if it's done under the guise of benefiting others. Jesus says that is not the kingdom way. The kingdom way is not a perpetual game of King of the Mountain where you fight to get on top and then you fight to stay on top. The way of the kingdom is the opposite of that. So how do you determine the goat in the kingdom? Jesus keeps coming back to this over and over and over. The greatest is the least. The greatest is like the youngest. The first are those who are last. You want to be lifted up? You've got to humble yourself. The highest are those who serve. And Jesus is not just someone who talks a big game. Jesus keeps modeling the life that he wants them to imitate. So he says, what would you expect? You would expect to find the greatest, the one with the greatest honor, the greatest authority at the table, at the most prominent place at the table. And yet, what does he say he does? I'm not the one simply lounging at the table. I am the one serving. And you may remember it's near the end of his life in this setting where Jesus in John 13 is washing the feet of his disciples. And near the end, he says, "You've seen what your Lord and Master does for you. You will be blessed if you follow suit. If you do what I did. If you do what I do." So some of you may have watched over the news the last several weeks, what was it, maybe 3 weeks ago now, when Tiger Woods, someone who's often described as a goat in golf, was in a horrible car accident. And his vehicle rolled down a hill, and there was a lot of questions, a lot of speculations. Is he going to make it out alive, one? And then some people started to say, well, I wonder if he'll ever play golf again. And others said, hey, you're asking that question way too soon. Will he ever walk again? And we still don't know. He's got a long road of recovery ahead of him. But that first weekend while he was in the hospital and being treated and all the things that were going on, golf tournaments still kept happening. And so something really interesting happened on that first Sunday. Tiger Woods is known for his Sunday attire. Red shirt, black pants. Done it his entire career that I'm aware of. Some of you who follow golf more may be able to tell me different. Maybe he didn't do that in the earliest days. But every Sunday, that was it. The black pants and the red shirt. And so at these tournaments that were happening that weekend, that first full weekend in the hospital, there were players, men and women, in the PGA and the LPGA who all showed up wearing their Tiger red and black. Now, I think most golfers normally avoid that because Tiger had that as his signature look, and no one wanted to look like they were copying his look. But on that Sunday, and there were a lot more, there were all of these people wearing the red and black because it was their small way to honor him. And Jesus says, if you want to honor me, you look like me. If you want to honor me, your Lord and your leader and your master, then you do what your master has done. You sacrificially care for others. You serve others. You give of yourself in the name of love. I want to end with a story about Elie Wiesel. Some of you may know that name. He was a Holocaust survivor, renowned Jewish theologian, and also a prolific author, written around 50 books. And in one of his books, All Rivers Run to the Sea, he tells of his family living in Hungary. He was growing up in the dark days of World War II as the Nazis continued to grab more and more Jewish families and some of the others that they captured and first sent them to ghettos to live and then eventually sent them off to concentration camps. And the family started to know it was only a matter of time before they would be rounded up. And he said in his town, there was a peasant woman named Maria. And Maria was almost like a member of the family. She, however, was a Christian. She was not a Jew. And so during the early years of the war, she continued to visit them until eventually the Jews were no longer allowed to have any outside visitors once they were put in the ghettos. And yet that did not deter Maria. She would continue to find her way through barbed wire any way she could, and she would bring the Wiesels fruit and vegetables and cheese. And one day she came knocking on their door and she said, I've got a small cabin in the woods. I would like to take the kids with me to hide them out, but we don't have much time. And the family talked And the family deliberated, and they didn't know yet about concentration camps that were coming down the road, including for Elie Wiesel. And so they made the hard decision to stay together as a family. But they were so moved by that gesture that for years later, he would continue to think back on Maria. And this is what he wrote. "Dear Maria, if other Christians had acted like her, the trains rolling toward the unknown would have been less crowded. If priests and pastors had raised their voices, if the Vatican had broken its silence, the enemy's hand would not have been so free. But most thought only of themselves. A Jewish home was barely emptied of its inhabitants before they descended like vultures. I think of Maria often with affection and gratitude and with wonder as well. This simple, uneducated woman stood taller than the city's intellectuals, dignitaries, and clergy. My father had many acquaintances and even friends in the Christian community. Not one of them showed the strength of character of this peasant woman. Of what value was their faith, their education, their social position, if it did not arouse their love? It was a simple and devout Christian woman who saved the town's honor." That question that he asks is a haunting question. What value was their faith, their education, and all of those positions of prominence and influence and power if it did not arouse love? So here's what's interesting about the way Jesus ends this section. He actually tells the apostles that they are destined for, they are going to be given great positions of prominence and leadership and significance within the kingdom. As the Father bestowed the kingdom on Jesus, so Jesus is bestowing on them this new kingdom and these really significant places within it. The point is not that we avoid positions of leadership or significance or prominence when God calls us there, when God leads us to those. The point is, no matter what your position, no matter what your prominence, the way we define and live out greatness in the kingdom runs contrary to the ways we so often see it. We do not define greatness by standing above, but by humbling ourselves and lifting up. We do not define greatness by the number of people who answer to us, but by the number of people we serve. Wherever you find yourself, whatever position of prominence or leadership in which God has placed you, use that place to live like Jesus. Not as one who has others waiting on them, but as one who is always humbly, lovingly serving those around.